I think in general, when we try to think who we target in the United States, so the main audience that we want to speak to are American Jewry. But it's obvious that if we go and give interviews to wider media channels, that it will come also to others, and it's not something that we oppose. I think, basically, I believe that what our struggle is to preserve an image of Israel as we want it to be, as we believe that should be, and that to a large extent is, which is we try to present an image of soldiers who are trapped in an impossible situation, not of some cruel and terrible human beings that do it just out of fun. We try to present a complex picture that shows how bad the situation is, but doesn't blame the army in being cruel. So I hope that in speaking in this way, we only undermine some anti-Semite criticisms against Israel.
The question about what your military training was like.
What my military was great. what can I say? I think at the whole, like when I left the army, I said, "Oh, thank God, I don't want to see it any time in my life again." I was serving 4.5 years. It's a long time, and I had enough. Looking backward, I think it was amazing time. I spent it with great friends. It was fun. I was lucky not to be a lot in the occupied territories, and not to confront this terrible situation that most of the other soldiers face. So I was with great friends doing pretty challenging work. It was good.
Do you worry that you are playing into the hands of the Arabs who still have the goal of destroying Israel, like Hamas?
Yeah. I think it when we just came out, so Yasser Arafat had some remark of how great it is that Israelis descend. And it's a kind of argument that can always, in any case, whatever you do, like anything that is less than fight them with all the force, can be blamed that. I think that the Hamas may be happy that something like this happens. This is not the audience that we direct our struggle for. And we struggle for Israel, not for... We don't struggle for the Hamas, to be clear.
In light of your view on the Israeli occupation, how do you view the present American war on terrorism?
That's a hard question, and I don't know if I have clear answer, because I don't know. I'm not keeping a clear track on what America does and doesn't do, and I hope it'll be safe. I think my general point of view is that when you can solve a problem not violently, try doing it first. And I hope that that's what America will do in the war against terrorism. Basically, I think that terror in general is a terrible weapon, but weapon that people can do with not much, like they don't need huge infrastructure of the state in order to be able to do. So sometimes waging war against state seems to be as not the right way to fight terror, like waging war against the whole Palestinian population is not the right way to deal with terror.
We do a couple more questions. We won't get through everyone, but we'll have gotten through most of them. There's a couple of questions asking you to say more about Zionism and what you mean by it. That Zionism has become a very charged term in recent years, and could you say more about your understanding of Zionism as a good and noble cause, and other questions about how you can justify Zionism given its elite and racist overtones, and could you say more about the Zionist ideals you mentioned in relation to courage to refuse?
Basically, what is when I am asked about Zionism, I think Zionism is the idea of that says that the Jewish people have the right for a state of their own in Israel, within this territory, what was once called Palestine, today hotly debated. But I believe that the Jews have this right for a state of their own. And I don't believe that it means that they can ignore the rights of other people who live within the same territory for their own rights. And it's very sad that Zionism usually is being interpreted as an idea of, enhance some territorial project of control of the whole state of Israel. I think it's a disastrous idea. But there is a way to live Zionism in a way that gives equality to the Palestinian citizens, give independence to the, independence or what kind of solution to the Palestinians that are not citizens. For those of you who don't know, there are two groups of Palestinians within the territory now called Israel. The Palestinians in the occupied territories were occupied in 67 war and didn't receive any citizenship. They don't vote in the elections, and they don't have citizenship with all what it means, protection by the civil law and all the rights that are conveyed with it. And there are other sizable minority of Palestinian citizens who live within Israel proper, that of course I believe that they should be equal citizens to the Jews.
Okay, we'll do two more questions. Why can't Jews live in the territories when Arabs live in Israel proper?
That's a hard question. I don't think that Israelis shouldn't live in the occupied territories. I think the occupation should end. In the current mode of settlement in the occupied territories, which means encroachment of more than 50% of the Palestinian lands in the occupied territories, of using more than, I don't remember the figures exactly, but using some 60 or 70% of the water that the Palestinians use, of preventing movement from Palestinians, of preventing their normal life, this kind of Jewish settlement, I see it as unjust, and they shouldn't be there. Other kind, well, if Jews will decide that they are willing to live equally to the Palestinians within the occupied territories, I hope that one day it will happen. It's a magnificent area. It's very beautiful. Why not? Right now it seems like a far dream. But if Israelis will be willing to live equally, to enjoy rights, to give the Palestinian rights, I don't see such a terrible idea.
Okay. Given the number of reservists in the IDF, what do you see as the prospect for getting a greater groundswell of signers to courage to refuse?
In the past, I was sure that the numbers will continue growing the more the occupation continues. Because simply people will go there, do their reserve, see how immoral, how illegal it is, and keep on signing. It didn't prove itself, or partly didn't prove itself. We had people joined Courage to Refuse in big numbers in the beginning, after the military operation called Defense Wall in March and April, the rate of enlisting to our list dropped dramatically. Today it's very slow. Basically, I still believe that as there will, in the long run, there will be cracks in the national unity that now we see in Israel, in this united support to Sharon, and as this will come, people will eventually start joining us, but it's obvious that now it's not happening. The one more thing, the terrorist attack is the most significant event that hinders enlistment to our list. And when people feel threatened so intimately in their own house, in their own streets, people turn into protecting themselves, even if what I believe is not really protecting, it's the other way around.
A couple of questions here about what U.S. Jews can do. Whether are Israelis aware of the opposition of a minority of Jews in the U.S. to Israeli policy? And would it be more effective for the U.S. Jewish community to place ads in the Israeli press rather than just the American press? Is there some way to communicate both our love and support to average Israelis, both those who support your position and who don't agree? And just in general, what can the American Jewish community do?
I think that there is a... It started, I don't know where it stands today, but there is an attempt of American Jews. It's called Brit Tzedek V'Shalom. And it's a group that kind of tries to take care of us in the States, to help us organize a tour of speakers and to try to convey this message of very strong and firm support to Israel, which means very strong stand against the occupation. They have website. You can see, like, they update when are their tours of Courage to Refuse and a sister movement that we have called Yesh Gvul. And they tried to launch campaigns. One of the ideas was publishing ads in Israeli newspaper of American Jews that say we support them, we think that the occupation must end. I don't know where it stands today. Please be involved.
That was Israeli peace activist and military veteran Danny Vos, founding member of Courage to Refuse. He spoke at Cornell University last week. This is Unwelcome Guests, broadcasting on WEOS in Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse. Dr. Hanan Ashrawi is a Palestinian human rights activist and former member of the Palestinian Authority, who resigned in 1998 over President Arafat's handling of the peace talks. She spoke recently with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash of Building Bridges about ending the cycle of revenge. Please excuse the muddy quality of the sound. We believe Dr. Ashrawi's insights will make the effort worth it.
President Bush used the word furious in relationship to the bombing in the university. And when there was a bombing by the Israeli Defense Forces that killed 14 people, he used the word heavy-handed. How are we to look at this double standard?
Yes. Well, if you're talking about the suicidal bombing, actually suicide is something that is very strange and alien to Palestinian culture. We are not suicidal. We've never had it in our culture, and people look at it as something very strange. But what drives young people to committing such an act? It's been described that the suicide bomber is the poor man's or the third world's equivalent of an F-16. Or F-15, or Apache gunship. People don't have sophisticated weapons and so-called smart bombs. They call them the smart human bomb. It's a way of reacting to the high-tech, impersonal, abstracted war that kills very real human beings from a distance and without accountability. When people have nothing else to fight back with, they use their own bodies. I don't want to see such a state. I tell you frankly, there are three reasons. One is ideology, the other is desperation and loss of hope, and the third is revenge. Now, when it comes to ideology, I don't believe that we should in any way accept the killing of others or the taking of civilian life in retaliation or as a means of telling them that the occupation is evil and must be removed. I mean, there is a deliberate dehumanization of the Palestinians and devaluation of our lives and rights. It's symptomatic of a mindset, as though the Palestinians somehow are subhuman, non-human, abstractions, but you always see the Israelis, who are the occupying power, the army, the soldiers, humanized and identified with, and you see the Palestinians excluded as the alien and the other, and of course labeled and conveniently dismissed. So when President Bush talks about sort of heavy-handed approach, this is the supreme understatement. When a one-ton bomb is thrown by an F-16 on the most densely populated area in the world, in the middle of a residential area, targeting an apartment building, and then killing, as part of Israel's assassination policy, not just the so-called target, but 15 people, Palestinians, including 9 children, with names, with identities, with parents, burying them in the rubble. And then he says this is heavy-handed. But that's symptomatic of how also President Bush has been dealing with the whole Palestinian-Israeli question, attempting to dismiss the occupation itself altogether, to totally disregard the brutality and the cruelty of the occupation, and at the same time to blame the victim, to bash the Palestinians repeatedly, and to dehumanize us in a way that would allow for the further victimization of Palestinians. It is very painful, it is quite immoral, and I find that the Palestinians, in a sense, feel themselves doubly targeted and victimized by such discourse.
As the Israeli repression does not achieve the purpose of stopping bombings in Israel, Israelis get fixed on more extreme forms of repression. Is there any way that you can see to get out of the cycle?
Yes, I think it is possible to get out of the cycle if you introduce new elements, if you stop being captives of the impulse for revenge, if you stop allowing your pain to speak instead of your reason and your conscience. But at the same time, we have to deal with the causes. That's the main issue. You have to understand the situation, which is the occupation that is giving rise to violence, and the fact that the occupation itself is the most systematic, comprehensive, pervasive form of violence and violation exercised against the whole captive population. So if you escalate and you use more violence, if the occupation goes to extreme measures and employing its military might, its Apache gunships, F-16s, tanks, missiles, whatever, it doesn't mean that it can destroy a people's will to be free. And it doesn't mean that, like any other colonial situation, that military escalation and oppression and brutality can subdue and crush the will and the spirit of a people who say, we just want to live like others, we want our dignity, our independence, our freedom like other people. And the Palestinians will not normalize the occupation or accept it as a form of contemporary enslavement that is acceptable. No. At the same time, I acknowledge the Palestinians have reacted by targeting civilians. Precisely, I think, many of them erroneously think that since the Israelis do it to the Palestinians, then it means we can do unto others what was done unto us. This is something that must be totally dismissed. The fact that we condemn the killing of civilians by Israel means that we must also condemn it regardless of who does it. We shouldn't adopt the same method, and we shouldn't legitimize or legalize violence. So we need to introduce new discourse to deal with people's despair, and you have to deal with people's need for revenge. And you have to demonstrate that the peaceful means can achieve results. So far they've achieved only more pain, more suffering for the Palestinians. And how do you get rid of revenge? By telling Israel that they cannot kill men, women and children impunity. When your own child or parent or sister or brother is killed, quite often people are driven to take revenge, particularly when they have no other means, when they see no other rectification. So you have to put an end to Israeli escalations and Israeli killings and Israeli massive targeting of Palestinians. But we need also third-party intervention to break this cycle We would like to see international forces, international troops. We'd like to see a serious commitment to a policy that is active and effective on the ground by the U.S., by the international community, to put an end to the occupation, to end this escalation, rather than to bash the Palestinians as in an attempt to pound them into submission and to accept their fate as victims.
How can we stimulate a broader interest of the international community in the context of the Sharon administration and the Bush administration?
Both have combined in order to exclude and to bash the Palestinians and to attempt to legitimize an occupation and subjugation by blaming the victim once again and giving free rein to the horror of the occupation. The U.S. historically has funded Israel, has supported Israel, has given Israel full immunity and impunity. So when Israel, as a country whose per capita income exceeds American per capita income, gets $3 billion annually from American taxpayers' money, which they say is equivalent to, what, $1,000 per Israeli, where they don't need it. And at the same time, they get between $3 and $4 billion extra in preferential treatment, in non-taxable funds that go to Israel. About $7 billion annually go to Israel, and primarily to military aid. And this is part of a negative form of intervention. When Israel is privy to American military secrets and sells them, when Israel's military program is being funded by the U.S., and then these are sold all over the world, when the internal domestic reality, political realities in the U.S. are determined by a very strong pro-Israeli lobby. What we can do first, we have to have people of courage who will stand up, who will speak out. People like in Israel, you have the army reservists who have refused to serve. You have new Jewish organizations in the U.S., not in my name. Jewish Unity, people who are standing up and saying Israel does not have a monopoly on our voice, on our moral standards. And of course, you need people who will refuse to the distortions of the conventional media. That's why I think your program is very, very important, because you need the courage to tell the truth, to address issues without being intimidated, without being subjected to all sorts of pressures and threats of boycott and so on, which is what's happening to the mainstream media in the U.S.
What have been the effects of the curfew, of the occupation, of the checkpoints, of the wall that Israel is building around itself on the everyday life of the Palestinian people?
Well, let me say frankly that this wall, this so-called separation plan, is one of the most oppressive forms of apartheid, because you are creating an apartheid racist situation on a people in their own land under occupation. So you have a siege and you have occupation and you have apartheid simultaneously, and you have, of course, land theft and land confiscation. So this so-called separation is a racist separation taking place on our own land, giving Israel the excuse to annex more of our territory, to maintain the settlers on the West Bank, on Palestinian territory, to create racist roads, to confiscate our land for bypass roads for the use of the settlers, linking them in an extraterritorial design with Israel, and at the same time imprisoning the Palestinians. So we are now imprisoned in our own Bantu stand, so speak, unable to connect, to communicate, to move from one town to another, from one village to another, from one refugee camp to another. We're imprisoned there. And to add to that now, the curfew is one of the most intrusive forms of violation, because it takes away your freedom. You are imprisoned within your own house, but you are deprived of your right to education, your right to health services, your right to work to earn a living, your right to go out and buy the food you need, let alone grow the food you need, your right to communicate and to commune with your own community and outside. It's not just destroying the collective economy of Palestine. It is destroying the livelihood of people. For the first time, we have people who have reached starvation level. You have about one-third Palestinian children suffering from malnutrition. You have 60% unemployment. You have a majority of women who are suffering now from anemia. These things did not exist in Palestine. We were among the most advanced in terms of services and health and education.
How do you look at the future of the Palestinian governance entities, particularly in the context of the arrogance of the U.S. government that would presume to tell the Palestinian people who their leaders can and cannot be?
We've had a long-standing democratic movement and a reform movement. Actually, I started the first, since the formation of the authority, even before that, the first Commission for Citizens' Rights in October 1993, and it started work officially in 1994. We have an oversight group, a watchdog commission, if you will. We've had more than 35 human rights organizations. We have democratic institutions that work towards reform and democracy. And when we told the Americans, the Israelis, the international community that this peace process that they were so hung up with as a process rather than as a means to an end, that the process has undue emphasis on the security of the Israelis without any regard for Palestinian human rights and democracy. They accused us of rocking the boat. They wanted a strong one-man show. They wanted a Palestinian security that would save the security system, that would safeguard Israeli security, regardless of how Palestinian rights are being violated and the distortions in Palestinian democracy are taking place. Now, all of a sudden, it's as though they discovered that instead of dealing with the occupation, instead of actually launching a genuine peace process with substance, why don't we just reform the Palestinian Authority as though that is the sole problem? We are capable of carrying out reform. We have been working on this. We have actually a coalition for accountability and integrity in government here in Palestine. We've been working. And we don't need a neo-colonial patronage to tell us what to do. What we need is intervention to put an end to the occupation.
What are we to do about the insatiable quest to appropriate the land of the Palestinian people?
In 1988, we came up with a definite commitment that we will accept the two-state solution. We will accept and recognize Israel on 78% of historical Palestine, provided the land which Israel occupied in the June 6th war in 1967 is returned to the Palestinians so that we can build our own independent state, a viable democratic state. Now, instead of recognizing the 78-22% division as a historical concession by the original inhabitants of the land, the Palestinians, they started haggling about how much land to take away from the remaining 22% from Gaza and the West Bank in order to allow for Israeli settlement, in order to allow for so-called Israeli security, in order to maintain Israeli security control, in order to control our resources, our water resources and our crossing points and our airspace and our sea space and so on. So the problem is that this government in Israel now, the Sharon government and its coalition, is based on land expansion, on land grab, is based on what we call the fundamentalist Zionist approach, which is to create facts, to take more land, to create facts that would render any type of negotiated settlement impossible to achieve. And that's what is happening now. The settlements have not only doubled, they've quadrupled since the peace process. Since Sharon took office, they've doubled. There have been hundreds of illegal settlements added to the already existing settlements. They call them outposts. 60 of them exist now. They fragment the Palestinian territory. They create a constant friction. And of course, they create a situation of apartheid and extraterritoriality. What we need to do is to begin to de-escalate and unravel the occupation. Instead, we are seeing a military escalation and unraveling of Palestinian reality and Palestinian lives. This is bound to generate greater conflict and greater suffering for both sides. All we need is for Israel to withdraw, for the settlements to be removed, for the Palestinians to have the 22% of historical Palestine that was occupied in 67, including East Jerusalem, and we will be able to create and build an independent state.
That was Dr. Hanan Ashrawi, Palestinian human rights activist and former member of the Palestinian Authority. Thanks to Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg in New York City for that tape. The history of the founding of the State of Israel is often told as a story of Jews returning to their ancient homeland and making the desert bloom, implying an empty and barren land. But the land that is now Israel was already filled with villages, orchards, and people. The Palestinians, who after suffering continual occupation by a variety of countries for centuries, were determined to have their own nation. Then, in 1948, came what they called the Nakba, the disaster, the formation of the State of Israel and the expulsion of 600,000 Palestinians. The Palestinians were sacrificed to assuage Europe's guilt for the Nazi Holocaust. Speaking such history is heretical, but Israeli historian Ilan Pappe believes that acknowledging and atoning for the Nakba is a prerequisite to peace. He was interviewed earlier this month by Jim Terrell at Kootenay Co-op Radio in Nelson, British Columbia. Following the interview with Ilan Pappe, we'll close with another interview with Sami Awad, a Palestinian seeking to build communication across religious divides.
I'm Jim Terrell, and I'm exploring the diversity of viewpoints about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Of special interest are individuals and groups with a nonviolent approach, cooperative projects in which Israelis and Palestinians work together for common goals, and the development of civil society. Dr. Ilan Pappe is a senior lecturer in the political science department at Haifa University. He's also the academic director of the Research Institute for Peace at Givat Haviva. Givat Haviva is the educational center of Kibbutz Artzi, which fosters educational initiatives, research, community work in peace, democracy, coexistence, tolerance, social solidarity. Dr. Pape's recent books include The Making of the Arab-Israeli Conflict, 1948 to 1951, and, more recently, The Israel-Palestine Question. He spoke to me by phone from Haifa. Is it accurate to say that you're one of the new historians?
Absolutely, that's true.
There's a word that's involved in that is a really touchy one here, and I gather from what I've been reading of your articles and stuff that it's touchy there. It's the word revisionism.
That's right. It's not so much touching as touchy as it is a bit confusing in the local scene, because on the local scene in Israel, the revisionists are Menachem Begin's party. This was the right-wing party during the pre-state era.
Oh, I see.
And they were called the revisionists. And therefore, people get confused when you talk in Israel about revisionist historians. They may think that you want to represent the point of view of the right wing, whereas this is why we never opted for revisionism rather than the new history, just to make sure that people understand that actually we come from the other side of the political spectrum,
right?
Which is, in Israeli terms, from the left, that is to say, more from the peace camp and not from the greater Israel camp, which
right.
is the this is on the local scene. The two terms can be it's a confusing term.
In North America, it's a confusing term because revisionist historians are people who deny the Holocaust.
The Holocaust, I know. I was once in a company of several historians in Athens who came from all over the world, and it was clear that there were two kinds of revisionist historians. Those who looked at the mirror and said, we were much more beautiful and honest and good than people tell about us. These were the French and the German. And there were those, like myself, who said, we were much worse than we were told. And this is much more like the Israeli revisionism.
Right.
So it's really, the message is much more important than the title, I would say, in this case.
You use that image of the mirror in several places.
A lot. Because I'm also an educator. I'm not just an historian. And I talk a lot to people who, you know, in schools, to teachers and students. And I understand that I'm facing an indoctrinating system that has shown the people a certain mirror that I'm trying to break, because I think what they're seeing is not what really happened. And that's very important for me.
Well, we'll come back to that a little later on.
Okay. That's right.
And I will call you a new historian. I think I'll avoid the quagmire of revisionism. You say at one point that no true reconciliation between Israelis and Palestinians can ever take place without full awareness of what happened in the Nakba.
That's true.
Could you explain for our listeners what the Nakba is and why you say what you say about it?
Yes. I think the Nakba, in putting it in other terms, we would call it ethnic cleansing. And ethnic cleansing means actually a mass expulsion of indigenous people from their own homeland by another people. So this is an act on a colossal level, almost a war crime, one could say, on a colossal level, that affected almost everyone in the Palestinian community. And any attempts to create a new reality in Israel and in Palestine cannot be done without acknowledging the fact that this had happened in 1948 and without discussing the implication of that act. And there are several ways of discussing implications of such collective crimes. We know that Desmond Tutu has taken South Africa in one direction, I think in a very positive direction, through his Truth Committee. And we know that in Rwanda, another place in Africa, people were going the wrong way about it, through retribution and revenge. So I'm not suggesting that. But what I'm saying is that such a collective trauma of the Palestinian victim that is still denied in Israel, still not acknowledged in Israel, repressed, is something that the Israelis would have to face, would have to reconcile with before any practical arrangement of how life together in 2002 could be arranged. And all the peace efforts since 1948, and I'm sorry to say that also the peace efforts that were coached by the Americans, totally ignored that fateful event of 1948, which is such a formative event in the life of both Israelis and Palestinians. It's almost, and with this I end this intervention, it's almost as if Israelis and Germans today would sort of reconsider their relationship without acknowledging the Holocaust.
Uh-huh. That's an interesting comparison. Takes us back to that revisionism question.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
I'm not comparing between ethnic cleansing and genocide. Genocide is far worse.
Uh-huh.
But I'm comparing a traumatic collective event that one people perpetrated against the other and does not acknowledge.
So the,
it's not the only case in history, by the way, that people deny the ugliest chapters in their history. But these chapters are like demons in a cupboard, you know, they come back to you. You cannot really get rid of them if you don't deal with them.
I understand that completely. I was going to talk to you about this later, but that's a card maybe I should put on the table. It's a question that I really want to ask. On a personal level, I was born in the United States, and I found refuge in Canada during the Vietnam War. So I've come to see what I think are similarities in the history of the U.S. In its relation to its own indigenous people. And
in a similar way, by the way, if I may, I'm sorry, I didn't want to
interrupt
you.
Please go ahead. No, go ahead.
No, I just thought about one of the things that was an eye-opener for me when I started researching 1948. I mean, apart from the fact that I realized that I was never told the story of 1948 in school, in the university, in my family, that I really had to reveal it myself. Of course, Palestinians knew that story all the time, but I was told to believe that this is sheer propaganda. One of the things I started revealing is how easily Israelis were using Arab names for villages they have eliminated and destroyed. And it reminds me in America how certain weapons have Native American names, like the Apache and the Tomahawk, which is a kind of a cynical reminder, if you want, of something that was there and was wiped out by force. And nobody acknowledges, but you have, nonetheless, you don't acknowledge it for many years, but you do acknowledge it by giving these terrible weapons the names of tribes that had been destroyed. But I'm not an expert in American history, so I shouldn't go too far into it.
Well, I'm certainly no expert on American history either, but my experience of American history is similar to what you describe with Israeli history. I certainly wasn't taught the kind of ethnic cleansing or even I think genocide in some cases. There were certainly whole tribes of people who were simply wiped right out, right off the face of the map. Today, people say, well, I didn't do it. I wasn't there. I wasn't responsible for that. And certainly I wasn't myself. But But it's hard to deny that where we stand now is a place that would be different if those events hadn't occurred, and that there are feelings on the part of those people that need to be addressed. You can't turn back the clock. We can only speculate about what might have been. But the question that I would like to put to you as a political scientist and as a human being is where do we go from here?
Yeah. Well, I think first of all, we go through the process of acknowledging. And for me, it's a formidable task, which I find very difficult to convince my own society. I say, first and foremost, acknowledge what has been done, and especially what you have done. Secondly, it might be worth your while to say you're sorry for what you have done. Mm-hmm. You might apologize for that. In various ways of apologies. There can be a symbolic act, there can be a compensation involved, there can be a willingness to include, as they do now in South Africa, to include in the textbook and the curricula what had happened. And then you are absolutely entitled to say to the other side, all right, now let's talk about practical implications. Bygones, in many ways, are bygones. As you say, you cannot bring the clock backwards. You cannot, it's inhuman now to throw out from the houses the people who inhabited them after the original people had been thrown out from there.
Right.
And I don't even know one Palestinian, by the way, who demands it. But after the acknowledgement and after the apology, I think there is a possibility to start talking about what political structures would be the best to serve the interests of both people. What would be a practical and reasonable and honorable solution to the question of refugees? Who should rule Jerusalem? In what way? But I think what we have done throughout the years of negotiations in the history of the Arab-Israeli conflict, that because the Israelis refused to go through that preliminary stage, the Palestinians felt that whenever they are signing an agreement about where the soldiers would be, what would be exactly the Palestinian state, what part of Jerusalem would be Palestinian, that they are forgetting something. And this is exactly what happened in Camp David in the summer of 2000, when Ehud Barak took together all these arrangements, which were done with totally disregard for the Nakba and what happened in 1948, and said to President Yasser Arafat, and now you should sign just another document. And that document says that you declare the end of the conflict. Namely, i.e., you have no more demands from the Israelis. But the basic Palestinian demand from the Israelis is that they would acknowledge that they are the victims of Zionism in 1948. They are the victims of an ethnic cleansing. And this is why the whole peace process collapsed in one day. And instead of peace, we had war, and so we still have this war going on.
So this is more of an answer to the phrase that is used all the time here. It's almost like a bumper sticker: is Barak's generous offer. You're saying that the reason that the generous offer was not a generous offer was that it failed to recognize the Nakba in the first place. Is that right?
It's part of it. And what was in, let's say that if the Israelis were very sophisticated, at least they should have offered a quid pro quo. They should have offered something that should replace the Palestinian demand for acknowledging the Nakba. What was on offer in Camp David? In Camp David, Ehud Barak offered a small Palestinian state without full sovereignty, without independent economic and foreign policy, with most of the Jewish settlements in the West Bank intact, and without any significant Palestinian sovereignty in Jerusalem. And this little Bantustan, this little protectorate, this little mini-state, without real sovereignty, almost a stateless state, was supposed to be the end of the Palestinian struggle. This would be the goal that should satisfy Palestinians for not making any further demands upon the Israelis, together with the fact that there was no mentioning and no reference to the major grievances of the Palestinians ever since 1948. This was an Israeli mythology that Barak made the most generous effort to offer to the Palestinians, and they rejected it. This is a mythology. This was not a generous offer. This was a dictate that suggested to the Palestinians that this is the best they can get because of the balance of power. But the balance of power does not always dictate workable arrangements, because the balance of power today is not necessarily the balance of power tomorrow. And the weak sometimes have, as we know from the unfortunate suicide bombs, the weak side, the weaker party, sometimes have weapons that ridicule the power of the stronger party, in this case nuclear capability, because nuclear capability doesn't help human suicide, in the war against human suicide, as we know. So this whole notion that you can sort of manipulate the Palestinians into a position where they would be shown as the warmongers, the rejectionists, was based on the balance of power, first and foremost. We are the stronger party, the Israelis, they would have to accept our dictate. And secondly, on the notion that you can really settle this bloody conflict, very charged conflict, without referring to the most formative year and to the most basic issue which lies at the heart of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
This is Jim Terrell at Kootenai Co-op Radio in Nelson, British Columbia. I've been talking to Dr. Ilan Pape from the University of Haifa in Israel. Sami Awad is a Palestinian peacenik. He's also the executive director of Holy Land Trust, a non-governmental organization in Bethlehem, which produces tours, multi-faith encounters, fact-finding missions, and nonviolence training workshops. This summer, he was on a speaking tour in the United States. I caught up with him in the Holy Land Trust offices in Los Angeles. He described himself and his work in this telephone interview.
Well, my name is Sami Awad, and I'm a Palestinian Christian from Bethlehem. I grew up all my life in Bethlehem until I had to come to the United States in order to finish my education in college and university after the Israeli army in 1987-88 shut down all educational institutes in the occupied West Bank due to the uprising, the Intifada, which took place at that time.
So that was during the first Intifada, is that right?
Exactly, during the first Intifada.
Okay.
I have a BA degree in political science from the University of Kansas, and I have a master's degree in international relations from the American University in Washington, D.C.
Uh-huh.
I then returned back to Palestine when I finished my education. I was here for about 8 years in the United States, returned to Palestine, and have been working for the Palestinian people, specifically in the Bethlehem area. I'm currently married, and me and my wife have a 3-month-old baby girl.
Oh, really? A baby girl born during the second Intifada?
A baby girl during the second Intifada was born during the April incursion into Bethlehem, where, if you remember, we lived under the siege of the Church of Nativity during that time under curfews.
I do remember that quite well. That must have been quite an adventure, having a baby during that time.
It was something very difficult for us because we knew Rana was about to have the baby at any time now, and the army was planning to coming into Bethlehem. So what we actually did was we actually had to escape from Bethlehem to Jerusalem, taking very bad and rough dirt roads in order to get to Jerusalem. We consider ourselves very lucky to be able to have that opportunity, and friends who were able to help us escape from Bethlehem. And we had the baby in Jerusalem, and a week later returned with the army still present, but returned to our home, because if we were not in our home, then our home itself would be in danger of being attacked and possibly destroyed by the Israeli army.
So you're back in Bethlehem after a period of education in the United States, and is it correct then to say that you formed the Holy Land Trust, or that the Holy Land Trust was formed after you got back? I understand it was set up in 1998.
Yeah. Holy Land Trust was actually initiated by a very big program called the Journey of the Magi. The Journey of the Magi was an idea that had been in development for several years prior to the year 2000. The idea was to celebrate the birth of Jesus in his 2000th birthday with a reenactment of the Journey of the Magi. And what actually happened was a number of people from different parts of the world participated in this journey, which we call the Journey for Peace. And they actually traveled for 99 days in the desert from Iraq, crossing the Syrian desert into Jordan and then to Palestine on walking and on camels. No vehicles were used, retracing the steps of the Magi, introducing themselves to the peoples of the land, praying with the people of the land, praying for peace of the Middle East, and then arriving in Bethlehem on Christmas Day, the year 2000. Holy Land Trust was formed with the Journey of the Magi, as both of them developed. The organization was also developed in 1998.
So that was your launching event, was the Journey of the Magi?
Yes. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Who are the people who participated in that journey? You describe yourself as a Palestinian Christian, and I have to say that it seems strange to me to ask you questions about that, except that you brought it up. If I were talking to somebody that I'd never met before in my own hometown, I would never ask to know about their religion or their ethnic background unless they introduced the subject. But I find that in talking to people about the Middle Eastern issue, that it's front and center. It's the first thing that that people talk about. So I wonder, I wonder what type of Christians? Was it primarily Christians who went on this journey? And if so, what types of Christians? Were they indigenous Christians? Were they Christians from around the world or what?
Yeah, the participants of the Journey of the Magi were Christians, and Christians from all around the world.
Mm-hmm.
We had four of the five continents represented. So we had people from Asia, Africa, Europe, and the Americas represented in this Journey of the Magi. The core group of the journey was 16 individuals. Those are the ones who actually did the entire journey from south of Baghdad all the way to Bethlehem. But throughout the journey, hundreds of people would join them for a one-day or a two-day a trip with them, walking and participating in their activities. Christians and Muslims from these countries welcomed them in their homes and asked them to pray for their peace and for their families. So it was a combination of religions and cultures that participated in this journey.
I see. So there were Muslims who were involved in it too, in a sense.
Yes, Muslims were involved in a lot of the preparation work. You know, we had to get approval from governments, so the Iraqi government, the Syrian government, we had the Jordanians, we had to get the blessings from these governments in order for the Magi to walk in their land and in their country. The Magi met with many Muslim leaders of the Middle East and introduced them to Westerners and foreigners who really cared for the situation of people in the Middle East, who saw the humanity of people living there, not just the big headlines of the news, what people think of people in Iraq and people of Palestine and so on. So it was very wonderful for both people to interact and see that there are people on the other side that really care and have concern about their well-being and their future.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like quite an exciting project. You sound like somebody who thinks that peace is possible in the Middle East.
I do believe so, and it has to be. Peace is the only way for survival. For everybody to survive in the Middle East, we need peace. So it's a must on us, and it's a lot of work. It's not easy to reach peace, but we need it, and I'm very optimistic that through the work we're doing, as well as many other organizations that are working on peace and justice, we will be able to reach peace in that region.
Well, let's talk about that in some more detail. What kind of role does the Holy Land Trust play in the peace movement in Palestine?
Holy Land Trust is one of several organizations that are promoting and teaching and developing with the Palestinian community new approaches to resisting the occupation, what we call nonviolence resistance to the Israeli occupation.
Mm-hmm.
We believe nonviolence is a very powerful weapon when used by the people. The Palestinians have a history of using nonviolence during the First Intifada in 1987. According to certain reports, between 85 and 90% of all activities conducted by Palestinians were nonviolent in nature. The Palestinian nonviolent movement can even be traced back to 1936 during the mass demonstrations that took place at that time.
Could you just pause there for a moment and give us a couple examples? Because that's, let me tell you something. You're talking about events that people here, I think, know next to nothing about, or maybe even absolutely nothing about. Those kinds of events don't break the surface of our media, and it would be really ground-shaking to hear some information about them.
Mm-hmm.
How about 1937? Tell what happened in 1937?
1936, yeah.
36.
In 1936, the Palestinian population participated and led a mass protest movement in Palestine calling for the British, who had the mandate over Palestine at that time, to grant the Palestinians the right to build a state and have a state under that land and mandate. And
where
they
did
participated in many activities such as economic boycotts, demonstrations on the streets, many activities of protest and so on in the streets of many cities in Palestine, demanding that they have the right to establish a state in that area.
So this was all over Palestine?
All over Palestine in 1936.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1987, during the first uprising against the Israeli occupation, again, all of the Palestinian population involved participated in many, many activities, such as, again, economic boycotts of the Israeli products, refusing to pay taxes to the Israeli military authority, closing of shops when the Israeli army was forcing people to open shops, and vice versa, refusing to go to work in Israeli factories and businesses. So many people who used to work in Israel during that time boycotted that completely. Palestinians who were involved in working with Israeli police forces just in basic civil duty also pulled themselves out of that function and boycotted that completely. Created a lot of pressure on the Israeli government, and it created a lot of awareness internationally about the reality of the occupation and the situation that Palestinians are living under.
My name is Jim Terrell, and I've been talking to Sami Awad. Sami Awad is the executive director of Holy Land Trust in Bethlehem.
Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guest is produced by Chris Sir, Jesse Lynn, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.